questions?
Great.
Well, thank you very much. Is there anyone else here who would like to make any remarks in terms of that didn't have an opportunity the other day? Okay, thank you very much. I'll turn over to Mr. Bender.
Mr. Chair, you don't have a quorum, so you're not able to open up the work session now. And the people who are for the public hearing, I don't know why they're not here, but there is a public hearing scheduled for Senate Bill 4. I think one thing that we could do that would not violate the committee.
See what's happening with 334.
All right.
Yes, that's why they're outside.
Oh, they're outside? Well, I mean, Mr. Chair, I think that one thing the committee could do without violating rules is just to, again, go on with a more general discussion of Senate Bill 334 without the intent of actually making any decisions right now. I can give you some more description, or you may want to wait until you get a quorum.
Are we going to get a quorum today? Mr. Chair, can I inquire, is anyone asked to be excused today? We're scheduled to start at 2:30.
Right, on the House side, I think we're okay.
We did not hear from senators to be excused, so I don't know.
Are we having a success?
Do you know if people aren't here? Maybe you could have Gary call.
He's called. Probably he's been called.
Senator Duckett is probably in committee with the stars on revenue also.
To have much of a discussion.
On 334?
Yeah, without everybody being here, because we're just going to have to do it again.
I think one thing I have to do is just pull them from revenue when we need a vote. We're going to get to the point on 334 to vote today.
Mr. Chair, I do understand that the intention was to generate an amendment request that could be worked on by council. The bill could be brought back on Monday with amendments that you desire, and then presumably that would be a very quick meeting if there are amendments reflecting what the committee wants.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bender, I think then the understanding would be is obviously we would not have an amendment today that we can act upon. We would only have a recommended amendment that would have to go to Legislative Council. And so
we need the
discussion, and we need to know where people are.
Right.
But we've got two members that are in revenue, and given what revenue may be working on right now, we might need to get split priorities in terms of one of them is the chair of revenue.
Right.
And the other one is, the other one probably might be supportive of some of the aspects. I don't know where Senator Morse is. That's the only one.
I just talked to him. He said that he reported he wouldn't be here, but he isn't here. He said he has to be in a meeting right now.
Okay.
Well, I think the concern is that if we don't have a discussion, I know
we don't get consensus here,
then we won't be ready by Monday with the to actually have an amendment drafted.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, Ms. Lau did come to my office and visit with me about some of these suggested changes, and I'm very intrigued by them and did want to have a discussion about them, but I don't want to have a discussion twice just because as a court reporter, I just have that issue of hearing attorneys say the same thing twice and the same thing here in committee. That I'd rather just do it once, but does this need to move by Monday?
Well, I think everything needs. I think you need to get something to Legislative Council soon.
I guess if we got something to Legislative Council on Monday, I don't think that would be a big problem.
I suspect Chair of Legislative Council is working over the weekend.
In one, like that same day, you want a product on Monday?
If I may clarify, we've been informed in LFO that the co-chairs would like subcommittees to complete all their work by next Thursday. So I do believe that if you do wish to take this up on Monday and come up with a requested amendment, we should be able to get that by Thursday and meet the deadlines for the subcommittee action.
Senator Devlin. Mr. Chairman, I do not want to take up too much time here, but I've had requests like this today, too, about meetings that are tomorrow. And I'm getting requests from people that don't actually want to meet tomorrow. And I've told them that they also have bills that they would like to have heard by the committee. And every day that we set something off and have less days to hear anything are less bills that I can actually get on the agenda or you can get on the agenda here.
Right. Well, so it seems like we have two, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like one choice is we can, we can start having a discussion.
Start having the
about
discussion.
About 334 on this.
334, I'm going to go talk to the revenue chair and tell him, ask him when he can get himself and Senator Starr back here.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, we could. To have this discussion without having people here, we're just going to end up having the discussion again when they get here.
Senator Walker.
You know, we can have a discussion online, and then the discussion is offline with missing members as to what the committee wanted. And these discussions have continued on the weekends before. I'm available by phone, and I'm actually here tomorrow because we have committee tomorrow. So, why don't we delay this the last time we have for anything else? And there are some policy bills that need to be heard in this committee.
Right. Okay, so why don't we just start, take a look at this, and maybe have, I don't know if you were going to start with this, and then maybe at some point we'd have Ms. Lau come up and answer some questions, and then perhaps we'll get more senators here and sally forth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Yesterday, when the committee was discussing Senate Bill 334, there was indication that it would be helpful to get a list of possible issues to go through for the committee to decide whether you needed any amendments to address these or whether you wished, if not to actually make requirements on the commission relating to the programs to state legislative intent as opposed to requirement, which, of course, legislative intent could be put in this bill as well as actual prohibitions or requirements that are legally binding. What I've done is I've distributed a table to you, which I've labeled decision matrix, Senate Bill 334B decision matrix, that listening to what some of the comments were both here and frankly remembering back earlier when we were talking about this before subcommittee and hearing what people had said when we were discussing the Oregon Student Assistance Commission budget, and this was mentioned, I've just listed 20 things here that are not necessarily all-inclusive, but I think are some of the issues that it would be helpful if we know whether these are things that you want changed in the bill or whether you're fine with the way they are. And the way this table is set up is where you see a star in a column, Senate Bill 334B currently either requires whatever the item is to be done, prohibits it from being done, or allows it. And when something is allowed but neither required nor prohibited, it is almost always the Oregon Student Assistance Commission's discretion as to choose whether or not to do this. So I put together this table to explain these things, to hear if the committee wants to move the star from allowed to required or prohibited. In every case where you would want to move the star, that would require an amendment to the bill. And then I have a column for preference where you may not want to require something to be done or prohibit something from being done, but you may want to say, well, we think that you should, the commission should consider this as the more important or less important or whatever. So, I mean, that's what I put together. Other information that you've received today is you have received, I've distributed to you a letter from Margie Lau dated June 14th, which is a request for an amendment that relates to the redlining of students that are currently in the Opportunity Grant Program to ensure that as the new program is transitioned into, that their particular awards don't decline. So that was one of the elements that is in Senate Bill 334.
Of course, it's a policy, you could take the whole thing out, but the request that they are asking for is that you keep that in, but that you improve the language, because there's some concerns that the language that's in there now to do this redlining of awards will not work entirely or will not work efficiently. So Ms. Lau is here to talk about that specific amendment request, which is not on this table here, so that would be something that would be in addition to that. I also see that there was I don't know if any of the members wanted to mention this. It was a shared information on the Shared Responsibility Steering Committee. One thing that LFO heard after yesterday's meeting was there were some suggestions that the steering committee, which has been established and which is operating, that you might also want to consider putting that into statute and adding legislative members to the steering committee. And we have some discussion that explains what the steering committee is doing, and you might want to discuss to see whether you do want to add legislators to this committee, either formally in statute or even just asking the commission to invite some of you.
Well, I'd like to ask Ms. Lau to come before us and talk about the last thing that you had mentioned about the steering committee. Not necessarily right now go into the decision matrix since we don't have a quorum, but I would like to hear a little bit more about what exists in the status quo and about the committee, and then this discussion about maybe in statute we should permit. So Ms. Lau, good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Margie Lau. I'm with the governor's office. And a transition from the Access and Affordability Work Group, which was more in the overall design side of shaping the shared responsibility model, we're now moving into more of an implementation advisory role that's needed to help steer the Student Assistance Commission staff on the rollout of the program. And for that, we've created a non-statutory steering committee that's made up of members from each of the three education sectors, financial aid, communities, but also... That's okay.
But this is going to recess in like 5 minutes, waiting minutes.
Okay.
So we'll have only about 5 to 7 minutes, and we have them for about 20 minutes. So we should do the OSAC discussion and get them back out of here.
Okay.
Windows of opportunity?
Yes. So I think if you just will continue, that's going to work out.
So it's made up of people from the financial aid community and each of the three different types of college environments. It also includes people who understand the demographics of higher education participation and adds in members from more of the policy setting side. Mr. Andine from the Independent Colleges is a member. We have a staff person out of the Community College and Workforce Development Department. We have experts on higher education administrative systems like Banner, who are helping steer how the interface works between OSAC and each of the universities on the awarding process. So it's got a variety of different memberships. That group met for the first time on Monday, and as a part of that, they began by more just getting up to speed with where all of the various parts are of shared responsibility. But we would suggest that from here forth, that developing a resource management plan that really looks at all of the variables and what we know and when we'll know more and better information would be one of their key charges, that they would help shape what that information needs to be, work with the staff on the most effective ways in which to collect it, and also response systems that both look at prevention of that risk occurring or mitigation for those things that we can't control directly. In addition to that, they'd work on the communication plan in terms of helping inform Oregonians about what the shared responsibility model does and how they can access the program, and also help advise the commission if there are resource constraints that emerge or opportunities on how to best deal with those changes.
Thank you, Ms. Law. I wonder if anyone on the panel, on the committee, has any questions about this, the committee, or any comments on just sort of this idea of, you know, putting into statute or, you know, adding. I'd invite some feedback. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In my humble opinion, it would be beneficial to put the nature of the steering committee in its charge in statute. I think it would provide greater clarity to the role and responsibilities of the steering committee. I do have a question for Ms. Lau. In addition to identifying the timetable for communicating with students who might take advantage of the shared responsibility model, my assumption, too, is that the commission would also be responsible for identifying the milestones associated with implementing the model as a whole. I think that would also address some of the questions, some of the concerns that arose in yesterday's discussion regarding potential cutoff dates, which I don't think we should return to, but at some point we need to understand the likely population that will be served by the program and its composition so that we can adjust the forecast for what the size of the awards and the length of time as awards can be extended before we potentially run up against the $72 million limit.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Edwards, yes, I think those milestones are important, and making sure that the right data is collected and available and understood at each of those milestones will be critical to being effective in implementing it.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Representative. Let me just open up, since we have a quorum, opening up a work session on Senate Bill 334B. Were there other questions or comments on this, on the steering committee? And if there are, I guess I'm trying to get a sense if people on the committee.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I need probably just a couple of minutes. I just got here.
Okay.
I've seen it just to read the.
I read it, Mr. Chair. If it's a consensus of the committee to do that, I think that makes sense. I'm willing to agree with it.
He's showing off. I'm trying to read it really quickly.
Take your time.
It was funny, Mr. Chair, because Senator Decker was reading this. He says, well, where's the legislators? And I said, well, that's what we want to do, is add legislators. And I think this is a really good proposal because there was some concern expressed yesterday that this may get out of control, that we don't have a handle on it so much because it is so brand new. And I think if you could put this steering committee and get a member from each chamber on it, that would help make sure that this works. There's nothing worse than opening up a new program and taking a great big huge step and then it all falls apart because you've stepped too far. So I think this would help provide a little bit of accountability and oversight for people who are feeling more uncomfortable.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Morgan.
I think that the key to this is going to be the ability of the steering committee to communicate to the legislature that there's very serious trust issues here around how this is going to unfold and the moves that the commission and the committee are going to make to deal with the reality of this. And I'm wondering if we could help facilitate that communication if we added the LFO analyst to the committee.
Mr. Chair, my response to that would be this LFO analyst could be made available, but as far as statutory, I'm not so sure.
My thought on that would be that the Legislative Fiscal Office is essentially the entity that's charged with doing the legislative or the fiscal analysis for the legislative body. And so if you have a person with expertise in the area that is looking at it from the legislature's perspective, that it would, I think, add to the discussion. I mean, there's DAS is on here, which has the same perspective from the governor's office perspective. And so I'm just throwing this out there. It may have the effect of streamlining the communication process into this part of the building or the process.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lau, correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't the current shared responsibility model budget include an analyst that we're responsible for continually updating and refining the modeling?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, yes, the $600,000 that was in the operating budget for the commission includes a position that's going to do econometric type of model building for the model. And I've been talking with people like Paul Warner about what would be the most effective way to recruit a strong person for that role. But in terms of legislative fiscal, I think that Mr. Bender, by his interest, will certainly maintain involvement with the program. It's fine with us if he's an actual statutory member, but I know that in the past, sometimes the legislative fiscal office has considered that being a member actually impairs their independent analysis ability. So,
Ms. Chairman, is there a double? I know we have a limited period of time here. One thing I would say, I mean, if you had members on here, first of all, I would make them liaison members. And obviously, they would have the ability to consult with LFO, and I think the committee would keep LFO informed. I had the good fortune during the last interim to serve on 14 interim assignments that were assigned within the building, okay, and four that were not assigned in the building.
Okay, good fortune.
Yes, and some of those assignments, there were supposed to be as many as four legislators assigned to, two from each chamber, one from each side of the aisle, and some of those, and Representative Morgan, I think, has had the same experience of being the only one in attendance. So I think giving the responsibility to someone to say that they're the liaison, that they have to keep track of it, is one thing. Expecting them to be able to attend every meeting that the staff from these various agencies can put together is probably a different question. So I would think if we would have one member from each chamber as liaisons, that would be probably sufficient. Senator Walker?
Yeah, thank you. I see LFO as sort of the GAO, the Government Accounting Office. They're an independent branch, an independent organization that we can consult with. I don't really see them as being on the steering committee. And I was reading Mr. Andine's testimony. He says, our campus financial aid officers and our students will be very dependent on the OSAC computers to generate these variable award amounts, and we're confident OSAC personnel can do this, as am I. And the steering committee, being statutory, can provide some oversight into that. And I think that gets us all the checks and balances that we need.
Steve, I wonder if you'd comment from the LFO perspective.
Well, we're just going to continue talking about you.
And the Comptroller General, Mr. Rocco.
I can't speak for the entire office, but I think that most likely our preference would be not to actually have the LFO appointee on the committee. The reason for this is the committee is really involved in an executive function in terms of administering the program that the legislature has set up. And they are ultimately responsible under the executive branch to the governor, both the commission and the governor, manages OSAC as an executive branch agency. So we like to be your employees as opposed to theirs. And we already are on the mailing list, and there's been one meeting of this committee, which was this past week, and I was not able to attend. But I'm sure that I or whoever is the LFO analyst in this area would attend the meeting without being actually a member of the committee. Okay. We do appreciate that suggestion. It would be helpful for us to be on there.
Thank you.
I'm looking at, are there other gaps or questions that need to be answered for clarification on this before we ask to have an amendment drafted? I mean, Representative Morgan, you mentioned, you know, sort of reporting back to, or communicating with the legislature, and it's, I don't know that it says anything specific about...
Well, there potentially could be a budget note that would direct the steering committee or the commission to report to the policy committees and the fiscal committees on some kind of regular schedule about what's going on.
Senator Devlin?
What were the requirements, Mr. Bender, in the OSAC budget? We had some reporting requirements there. I don't know if they were that extensive, but they were more extensive than normal.
The reporting requirements in the budget note in the OSAC budget was a one-time reporting requirement for the commission to report back to you. Essentially, you set the deadline so that the report would come during the planned February special session to basically report on the an update on the implementation of the model, where they've gone, how far they've gotten, and what the proposed award levels are, because we don't know yet what the actual proposed awards will be. So that was the request. It's a directive to the agency to make that report.
And of course, and we're talking about a policy bill.
Right. So there won't be a budget report. There won't be an opportunity for budget notes unless you add more money in this bill or take some out. But this is a statutory bill. You, of course, have the options that you don't have in a appropriations bill of putting it in statute.
Is there an option of putting budget notes in the final reconciliation bill?
Yes, there is.
Can we,
Ms. Chairman?
Can we do, I want to say, I think, I can't speak obviously for Representative Morgan, but probably I think there are members of the committee that would like more frequent reporting of that, of the activities. Could we put something in that would be basically just to report back to the respective committees on like a quarterly basis about the activities? And I think since you have the shared responsible steering committee, I mean, that's something you've established. If we're putting this in statute, I would hope that we would put a sunset on it that was maybe at the end, the end of the next legislative session, because we could decide then whether to extend it. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't want to have this permanently in state law. And the other thing is, I just think that I know Mr. Bender has worked with a lot of people. I didn't think anybody would ever capture in this short period of time what a lot of the committee comments were and the testimony in terms of how the program might be modified and the preferences. But I think to a lot of people, I don't know if everyone here is satisfied with this, but I think that's a very good reflection in only a few words about where I think a lot of us had hoped the sort of parameters would be.
Thank you. And Senator Devlin, so where it says that there is a sunset at 4 years.
Did they say four? Four is an awful long time.
Four?
I know you're on 14 committees and you might have missed that part, but I just want to say, are you saying that's okay with you, the four?
4 years is 18 committees. A long time.
You said four more.
I would get one night and say four more. I would say till sunset July 1st, 2009.
Right. And
so
it can be extended.
Yeah, sunset can be extended.
Right, by the 2009 legislature. I think that's a great idea.
Mr. Chair, I would think that perhaps 4 years is more appropriate because we will have only been in 1 year, and it's really pretty early to really discern trends in a single data point.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just hoping everything is nice and clear and there, and all this works fine.
Me too.
But I'll go with whatever.
So, Steve, is there more information, or I don't know, is there more information that you would need to, or we would need to get a sense of the committee?
I understand where this discussion has gone, and the set of amendments that we bring back to this subcommittee on Monday, we can include this either within the total amendments or as a separate one. It could later be combined.
Representative Morgan.
I'd just like to make one voice one concern I have. We got testimony yesterday about potential issues with the model, and that there's a significant potential gap between the demand and the funding level that is in the neighborhood of 26-27% potential funding shortfall. And I have concerns if that actually does materialize and the balancing on the available grants and the pool to apply them to will be closed for those with the greatest need first, meaning that students that have the least amount of need for financial aid will be outside of the applicant pool. What that's going to look like in terms of actually implementing the shared responsibility model, because with that kind of a funding gap, it would seem that there's a large potential to exclude the top end of the income stream, and I'm not sure that really is conforming to the whole idea of the shared responsibility model, which is to make college affordable or higher ed affordable for all students, not just a certain group of students.
Senator Walker.
Yeah, I was kind of... I believe it is, but if you only have so much money, I would advocate that you have to exclude some of the top income level, because I, quite frankly, don't know how you're going to do it if you don't. That's why I said about baby steps. If we have a shortfall here, I'd like to expand to make sure we can go up as high as we can go on the income level, but... I mean, I don't know if that's what the governor's office or Ms. Lau was thinking, but I mean, as a person who used the Oregon Opportunity Grant, I can tell you that I wouldn't be very happy here as a very, very poor person, getting $400, because we've got to make sure that the person who comes from a very wealthy family background gets a lot more, or gets the same amount. I just have issues there. Maybe Mr. Chair, can Ms. Lau respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, we think that the families who have more resources have more options in terms of how to cover any potential reduction that we might have to do than what would be faced by the families with the very least amount of resources. And that's the reason why we would propose a more progressive approach. So, and that's where the multiplier that we use against the expected family contribution is an effective way in which to do that.
Right. Okay.
So, looking at, we've got about five more minutes.
Four more minutes. Three, actually.
Three more minutes. I guess if I say another word, it's going to go to 1 minute. So, do we have some degree of consensus?
It would be something that I would hope that we would watch as we watched how this program unfolded, because I think it's important that there be a broad access to the program.
Yeah. I don't think in any case we're talking about wealthy people. I think we're talking about middle class folks who are struggling. So. Steve, do you feel like there's enough information where we can have an amendment drawn up, putting in statute?
Yes, I think for that part, I don't know if the committee wants to go through the decision matrix or if you've done it.
Probably get the consensus and then we go through the matrix.
Okay, I think we have the consensus. Procedurally, we don't need to do a motion and have a conceptual amendment.
No,
we're just going to get it drawn up, right?
I think, yes. I think, Mr. Chair, it would be good to have an amendment before this committee that you can vote on. Typically, we don't do that in subcommittee because the amendments are just number changes. But since these are actual words and, like, a substitute bill, we would like to have an amendment before you that you can vote on.
On Monday?
Yes.
Yeah, I guess whatever you want to do.
Mr. Chair, I would also state that I understand there are some rules in the House that policy chairs have to give permission to amend their policy bills. This did come from my policy committee.
You have your permission?
So if you need my permission, you've got it.
Thank you very much. That was very convenient. Well, in the remaining 7 seconds that we have this decision matrix in front of us. Maybe Mr. Bender can...
He's got like one minute.
Okay, you can make a decision on 20 different things. So now...
Representative.
suggestions?
Well, Mr. Chair, just to kind of cut to the chase here, I think that the expertise on how to adjust this program is with the commission, that they're the ones that know how to do this. And I think that the key, from our perspective, is their communication with us. Mm-hmm. And so I would hesitate to, I think that, you know, we've had a discussion here about the concerns that we are surfacing around the adjustments, but I would hesitate to put anything like this in the bill amendments. I think that we need to, you know, we've already had a pretty good discussion around where we think each of these falls in our own personal realms of importance, and that may be all we need to do.
Mm-hmm. Senator Walker?
I agree. I was there yesterday.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate all the work that's been done on this, and I do think it actually, a lot of it mirrors some of the work in terms of the verbiage that we have. I'd be comfortable proceeding now, and I think Senator Starr and Senator Deckard will be comfortable also. So. That was our indication as they left.
Well, Mr. Bender, do you want to say something about number one?
Yes, Mr. Chair, as your staff, we do have concern about one of these items, and that's the first one. We believe, we would recommend to you that you require that award amounts in the program be adjusted when program costs exceed or fall short of available funding. That was that's consistent with the budget note we passed for OSAC, and we are concerned that by not requiring that, there could be instances where eligible awardees do not get awards. If that is the policy that you want to allow, then do not make this change. We were under the understanding that you did not want that to happen, and in order to assure that didn't happen, we would recommend making that change in the bill.
Questions with regard to that. Having been a student and received these awards, when would you make the change in the award amount? Because usually we get the financial aid package, we get it all in the summer, and they tell you what you have for each term available. So are you suggesting that if the money doesn't seem to be working out, we don't have enough money, that somewhere in that year where someone's banked on going to college with this much money each term, that you would midstream during that year change the award amount?
If it turned out that the amount of money that was available from the legislature to fund the program was insufficient, because the commission can't borrow, it would have to do something. Mm-hmm. And it could essentially make a decision to not make awards to some students without reducing award levels to others. That could also happen mid-year. If that's when they determine that they don't have enough money, they could, for example, say that only students who are full-time are going to actually get awards for the spring term because we've decided that we don't have enough money. The question is, do you want that to be permissible, or do you want to indicate that you do that the program essentially be tailored, that the commission basically provide a set of awards that are affordable given the amount of money that you have approved as a legislature for that biennial budget?
Senator Devlin?
Mr. Chairman, I think the general discussion of the committee, perhaps not the budget note that was adopted as part of OSAC, but the general discussion of the committee has been, with some exceptions, I note that, to keep the breadth of students that would be covered with awards as broad as possible, but not to actually reduce awards to the point where you lose some of the basic things that you are trying to do in terms of making it possible for a student to attend. And I guess that puts a huge onus actually on OSAC in a sense, not to overextend in awards to the point where they would actually have to come to the legislature and do that. Because in a sense, I think Mr. Bender is right in the respect that if they extended out too many awards and they were all at these levels, you could get it very easily get into a situation where you had basically granted people more than you actually had. But I think the onus is more on that we don't want you to actually go against the underlying principles of the program. And so it's, you've got to be extremely careful on just literally how many awards you give out. I mean, there, even in the language here, we do have some language that we put in terms of, you know, as literally as last-ditch ways to solve the problem. We're saying last-ditch, you are going to, we don't want you to, but it has to be really, I hate that word, how do you say financial exigency? that you might have to, under those kind of circumstances, go back to, and that's what it says in this language, go back to not covering part-time, go back to cut-off dates.
Mm-hmm.
But in a sense, we would like the awards to actually fulfill the original purpose that the program was designed to provide.
I wonder if Ms. Lau would comment on this.
Mr. Chair.
Do you have this in front of you? Do you know what
I do.
Okay.
I think that this is something that we would work hard, very hard, to avoid having to do. But, you know, another concern that the committee's had in the current biennium is the fact that so many of the funds were underspent. And so if we're too cautious, we could very well end up in that same dilemma in 2009. And there's a huge opportunity cost with failing to award with the funds that are available. So I think what we'll probably do is send out award notices, but we will include in it language that says that, you know, this is the projected award, and you can count on it for fall term, and depending upon demand, you know, we hope that you can count on it for the subsequent terms, but there's always, it's subject to the available funds. So, and you know, some of the funds that OSAC administers that are scholarships from the federal government go out with those same kinds of provisos you know, this is awarded to you based on existing law, but it's subject to continuation in the funding from the federal government. So it's not unheard of.
And would that be in like two fonts at the bottom, in the very corner? Really? Okay. Representative Morgan.
I appreciate these comments because I think that we need to bear in mind that the whole formative concept of the shared responsibility model is a kind of a holistic approach to getting students to completion, and that if we are going to decrease by too much the amount of the state component to this, we're going to end up, I think, shooting ourselves in the foot, essentially, because of the inability of students to continue to pay the cost of education. I think there's a great difference between whether you're talking about a $50 reduction or a $500 or $1,000 reduction. So there is probably an aspect of this that's applicable, but I think the overriding principle that underlies this whole thing is affordability to completion, and that has to be one of the paramount pieces that's in play. And I appreciate hugely that this is incredibly dynamic and unformed, and something that you're going to be trying to get your arms around as you're trying to make it happen. And again, I think that the success here is going to boil down to communication.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, given the substance and tenor of the discussion so far on this issue, I would suggest we consider changing
item number one from a strict prohibition to a statement of principle. So perhaps we could change it to something along the lines of the commission will consider current recipients or place a high priority on current recipients to ensure they're not harmed by the SRM implementation insofar as it's possible. Something along those lines where we indicate that one of the first principles ought to be to hold those folks harmless but not make it a strict prohibition, which might restrict their flexibility in implementing the program.
I just wonder if considering what we've, the possible amendment that we're going to have with the steering committee, with a couple of members from this body, and with the discussions we've had, and quite frankly, with the desire among everyone here to not put students in a situation that I'm wondering if it's even really necessary. I don't know. I mean, so you were going to say something about that more?
Well, I'm wondering if maybe just adding something under between one and two that just kind of outlines the discussion we're having around not wanting to decrease the amount of the wards past the point where it doesn't enhance completion.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I think Representative Levin's going in the same direction I'm thinking too. I mean, you can reduce awards proportionately across the system instead of leaving someone with no money. I mean, I know that when I got my awards, if I had gone to collect my financial aid for spring term and found suddenly I'd been given notice that I'm not getting my money, I would have broke down and cried and wondered, well, what the hell am I going to do now? Because, I mean, I was eating a lot of macaroni and cheese and Spam to get by. That was before I became a vegetarian for a while.
that's not a vegetarian.
Spam, I'm not even quite sure what's in it, other than pork of some kind. But, the point is that, and the students, we really live very frugally, and you just can't be hit with that kind of a thing. And I don't think OSAC would do that. I think they're very careful about this, and I trust them. I mean, Mr. Andean trusts them. I trust them. I've dealt with OSAC for years and with my own children and through my years at school, and we just have to have a little more trust here, but I think Representative Morgan is going in that direction.
Senator,
Mr. Chairman, the concern I have about actually, and it's the same as Representative Morgan, about only reducing the actual amount of the awards in an extreme circumstance, is that with this model, we have placed more onus on the student to actually contribute directly to their education. We put some reasonable expectations on how much that they can make working part-time during the year and part-time during the summer. And not every student's going to have a scholarship or something like that. And if it was, I mean, we could say $50 or $100 isn't that much, and that's probably survivable. But if your award was reduced from $3,500 to $2,500, it may make the whole difference between you being able to attend the next term or not attending, mm-hmm. or taking that extra three credits that you might graduate that year, or having to do another term the following year. I mean, I can see a really overt need here for the legislature to monitor this as closely as possible, because it's a new frontier. Somebody had there was some president.
Yes, yeah, some.
But I don't think we want to lose the underlying principles that we're trying to adhere to.
Okay, so here we are. So we got 20. I mean, we've got another bill on the docket, yeah, to discuss. So, getting a sense that, are you saying, Senator Devlin, that you would advocate
doing something like this?
This is like a principle, or
principles like this. That's pretty much reflecting that what we really want to have in the program, and we understand that there has to be at the end of it an escape valve if that you are actually in if you're actually seeing a deficit on the horizon, you might have to take some very, some things that you would not normally want to do, just as most of us did in the 2002 special sessions when we went and cut budgets far greater than any of us really ever wanted to do.
So that wasn't clear to me whether, and I guess I need a little bit more sense of the committee, and do we want language vis-a-vis number one stating a principle, or do we feel as if this is adequate what we have here?
No, I don't think there's anything in here that addresses this issue.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm getting a sense that we... I'm getting a sense that we don't have any consensus.
Well,
that's the consensus.
I kind of disagree. I think the fourth one, it says that the state should not return to past practice of cutoff dates or failing to assist part-time students unless there are very serious financial circumstances that cannot be addressed. I mean, if you just simply add into that or reducing awards, but basically, I mean, it's just direction to the...
Right, reducing awards during the current academic year.
Yeah.
The state should not return to past practice of cutoff dates, reducing awards during...
unless it's absolutely
blah, 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 or failing to assist part-time students. Yeah. I'm good with that. Are you?
The chair wasn't listening.
No, I knew you weren't listening. Bad, bad, bad.
Does that mean now you've forgotten what you were saying?
No, we were sort of inserting here the state on number four. The state should not return to past practice of cutoff dates, reducing awards during, Ms. Lau, what did you say?
The academic year.
During the academic year, or failing to assist part-time students, blah, 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 in the rest of the sentence.
Unless there are literally no other alternatives. No.
I mean, that's pretty straightforward.
That gets it all, I think.
This is under the Department of Extraneous Language and...
Probably they didn't give some direction to the commission.
Well, Mr. Bender, do you have a decent sense of what the committee would like to see in terms of coming back on an amendment?
Yes, we'll bring back some amendments for your consideration.
Okay. All right, good. With that...
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Oh, wow.
The grandfathering provisions, I think it's important that those be clarified as well, or we could end up chewing up a lot of energy doing administrative hearings around appeals.
Right.
So that's
the current, recipients.
Yes.
I think most of this.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, most of these items are the general direction.
Right, that's in this document already, yeah.
But you were requesting...
Actually, Mr. Chair, she's referring to the letter
this letter,
June 14th now.
Yeah. Yes, because Section 7 has some language, but it's pretty cloudy in terms of its implementation.
Okay, so we will have minutes with that too, so on Monday.
Okay.
So, well, thank you very much. Thank you, committee. With that, I'm going to close the work session out on Senate Bill 334B and open up a work session. Public hearing. Sorry about that. On Senate Bill 4A. Mr. Bender.
Mr. Chair, members, I've prepared a small packet for you on Senate Bill 4A. It includes the staff measure summary from the Senate Committee on Health Policy and Public Affairs, which is where this bill came to you from. This bill would establish a nursing shortage coalition committee, and it would provide additional funding in the amount of $2.7 million to address the nursing shortage in Oregon. Just to give you a little background, reminders here, I've added information on numbers of registered nurses and the size of the program, licensed practical nurses. You did, in the various budgets you've approved, provide about $9.6 million for nursing education enhancements, which would cause an additional 162 degrees we're expecting for registered nurses each year, and a number additional 20 degrees for master's nurses each year.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bender, and I believe we have some
Yes, we don't have a sign-up sheet, but...
Do we have people who are here today that would care to come and testify on Senate Bill 4?
Four A.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chair Galizio, members of the committee, for the record, Kristen Leonard on behalf of the Oregon Center for Nursing. Wanted to very quickly say a public thank you to Senator Lori Mona Sanderson. This is a bill she's been working closely with. She had come by the hearing today at 2:30, but had other engagements at 3:30 today, so wasn't able to stay and lend her support. And with that, I'll actually turn this over to the experts, Chris Campbell, the executive director of the Oregon Center for Nursing, and she can start, and then Susan King from the Oregon Nurses Association will also be here to answer questions.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Galizio and members of the committee. I'm Chris Campbell, the executive director of the Oregon Center for Nursing, and my purpose here today is to tell you a little bit about who we are, what we do, and why we're here. You have my testimony in packets, so I will do an abbreviated version of it. If you want more details, it's there. And I have already testified before this committee, so I'll do a very quick review of who the Oregon Center for Nursing is. It's a nursing workforce center that was created in 2001. I actually opened the doors in 2002 to solve the nursing shortage in Oregon, to execute the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council strategic plan to solve the nursing shortage, and we've been working on it since then. The members of the Oregon Center for Nursing are the major nursing organizations in the state, which are the Oregon Nurses Association, the Oregon State Board of Nursing, the Northwest Organization of Nurse Executives, so those are the executives of the hospitals and health systems, the Oregon Council of Deans, those are the deans of the baccalaureate and higher programs of nursing, and the Oregon Council of Associate Degree Programs. And those are the directors of the community college nursing programs. So we have all the major players executing the strategic plan. We are a nonprofit organization, and our mission is to provide the leadership to solve the nursing shortage in Oregon. And we are funded primarily by the Northwest Health Foundation. We had a one-time federal grant, lots of grants that I've written, and fundraising. And we are also supported by the University of Portland. They donate office space and services to us. We started with research to make sure we knew what was going on in this state. And we've done a couple studies. What we do know is that we have a nursing shortage, and it's going to get worse. If the demand for nurses continues as we expect it will be, we will need in another 12 years almost 16,000 additional nurses. Couple that with the fact that about half of the nurses in Oregon are over 50, so we're going to need a lot of replacement nurses because they're all going to be retiring, and the exodus has already started. We have a lot of interest in nursing now. We've expanded program capacity in the state. It's been a statewide effort, and I think you've heard about some of that. Of the community colleges, OHSU, and our private institutions, we are graduating 76% more nurses than we were in 2001 with that collective effort. That's not going to get us where we need to go, but it's a humongous achievement. We have now 6 applicants for every position in the state, and that's because our faculty shortage is one of our most critical shortages. The Oregon State Board of Nursing, in a survey that was done in June 2006, from all of the schools in the state predict that they will need 92 additional faculty within the next 3 to 5 years. So those 20 additional seats at OHSU are wonderful, but we need a little more. So this bill is about funding the work of the center. It's about retaining nurses that we already have practicing and hard to recruit for areas, and about establishing the Oregon Center for Nursing. The nursing community is having an advisory role with other entities in the state that make decisions about the nursing workforce, because we do all work together. It's statewide work, and we want to do that because we want to maximize the use of resources with people and money in the state, and we do that by working collaboratively. The retention piece is, we already have talked about faculty, but the other state nurses are mental health nurses and public health nurses. In Multnomah County, in Multnomah County Health Department, 66% of the nurses are over 50, and another 21% are in their 40s. So whatever we can do to retain the nurses that are already practicing there, and most of them are long-term, that the PERS relief would help with that. And also with the state hospital, their nurses are on average older than the nurses, the statewide nurses. Their nurses, their average age is 50. And their average length of working there is 9 years. So we know that the nurses who stay there are committed to staying there. So whatever we can do to keep them working longer would be helpful as well. We will continue our grant funding. We will continue fundraising. In fact, just last Thursday, we had a huge fundraising event. We raised $300,000 for nursing education in the state. None of that will come to the Center for Nursing. The money is all earmarked for faculty development, program expansion, and nursing student scholarships, but it was the right thing to do because it brought money in for education in the state. I heard the discussion about scholarships earlier. And we will continue to do our golf tournament that actually raises enough money to pay for an assistant. The programs that we develop, and there's a lot of the programs are in your packet. We have tried to create to be sustainable. But the big issue, the really big issue, is that it's really difficult to get grant funding for operating funds. Northwest Health Foundation has been fabulous to us and have promoted operating funds, and they also taught Kaiser Permanente into giving us operating funds rather than program grants. So the money in this bill would allow us to have the operating funds to get a grant writer to continue also to do the grant writing and the fundraising that we do for programs, because that money is much easier to go after. One of the programs that we did develop with a $30,000 grant, was a Student Max clinical placement program to support the program expansion of the nursing programs in the state. We now have, that is a sustainable program now, and the monies that we have generated from selling licenses, we sold the license to 12 other states, is now paying for someone to run that. So we know we can do this work if we could get the operating funds to continue to move forward. I am a nurse with many years of experience and a lot of education. My time is best used developing programs and working with other organizations that are developing programs and executing programs to solve the nursing shortage in this state, as opposed to fundraising. So I would appreciate this funding so we can continue our work. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Campbell. Ms. King.
Good morning, afternoon, excuse me, Chair Galizio and members of the committee. My name is Susan King. I am a board member with the Center for Nursing and the Executive Director of the Oregon Nurses Association. I am here with Chris and Kristen to urge you to assist us with our work. What I'd like to concentrate on very briefly are amendments to the bill. I hope you have the Dash 12 amendments.
It's in your packets. In the purple Oregon Center for Nursing packet.
What these amendments do is are drastically altering the bill as you saw it as it first was introduced. You should have a schematic that looks something like this in the packet. We've attempted, actually Kristen is the artist, has attempted to sketch out for you how the amendments would affect the work that we're doing. So let me just very briefly tell you what these amendments are, and then of course I'll be happy to answer any questions. Section 1 is unchanged. That would require a declaration of an official shortage of nurses in Oregon. Section 2 is really represented by the boxes, and let me just concentrate on the left side of that diagram. This would codify, the amendments would actually codify the role that the Center for Nursing would play in dealing with other existing entities that have an impact on workforce, healthcare, and otherwise. the Workforce Investment Board and the Joint Boards of Education. And so in the amendments, the Oregon Center for Nursing would become advisory to both of those boards. It is our intention that if we are able to play this advisory role, we can have some of the effects that Chris has already talked to you about. We know that in this world, there is never going to be enough resource to devote to the programs that we would like. And our work for the last 5 years through the Center for Nursing has been to maximize existing resources. We have been a part of a consortium of community colleges and OHSU that is now streamlining the educational process so that nurses can move through with a consistent curriculum. Prior to that time, we had many different silos, if you will, where there were competing requirements, course requirements, that often resulted in students taking much longer to get through programs than was necessary. And it is these kinds of efficiencies that we would like to have the ability to affect if we could be advisory to two of the entities that deal with them. Section 3 creates a voluntary exception to the current 17.5-hour rule for group health insurance for nurses and nurse faculty. We have many nurses who are semi-retired who may be willing to come back on an episodic or periodic basis to their healthcare setting. And often what their interest would be bridging that time period between their retirement or semi-retirement and the advent of Medicare, as long as it continues to exist. And so their interest would be in being able to be a part of their group health benefit plan through their employer. And that's what Section 3 would do. Section 4 creates an exception to the PERS 1039 rule specifically for nurses and nurse faculty. We have a serious problem. And I'd be certainly happy to answer some questions about the specific way that the 1039 rule plays out, or 1040, I guess it is. And Section 5 is the funding that we are requesting. As Chris said, we can either implement programs that are really going to make a difference in our long-term nursing workforce in this state, or we can expend our valuable staff time in going after fundraising efforts, but we can't do both. And this bill, as it's amended in these Dash 12 amendments, would secure operating funds over the next biennium for the Center for Nursing to do its work. We believe our outcomes are already clear. We also believe that investing in your nurse workforce is a good investment for the state. The average salary currently for nurses statewide is $61,000. So nurses are good taxpayers. This is a viable industry, if you will, for the state, and we hope that you will agree with us. This is a good investment. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. King. Ms. Leonard, did you have any?
No, we're available for any other questions you may have. Okay. Any of us.
So. Are there any questions? Senator Devlin?
Yeah. Question for Ms. King. In some of our earlier discussions in this committee, actually when we were back reviewing budgets, an issue came up over the nursing shortage. And one of the things that I think the committee started to get some exposure to was it just wasn't simply an issue of numbers. It was an issue of nurses are not, they don't come in one single, one simple brand. That's probably not a good way to say that, but they, it's actually, it's broader than that. It's the specialties that they might have. It's, could you comment on that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator Devlin, Chair Colizio, and members of the committee. The issue that I believe you are addressing is that we have to achieve an improved workforce in the generic graduates of nursing programs. So we have to get an RN population that is sufficient in numbers to care for the Oregon population. But in addition, we have to prepare them in such a way that they are ready to practice in specialties that we have critical shortages. And those current critical shortages are in psych mental health. I know all of you are very aware of the conditions in our mental health services across the state. We have to have people with expertise, so they have to start with a good foundation and educational base. But in addition, we need to develop programs that assist with specialties. Public health, health is another specialty that's not often attracted to many nurses. And so we need to make sure that we have programs that are assisting those those registered nurses who have the basic education to move into specialties. And those are the types of programs that the Center for Nursing is interested in. What can we do to affect specialty practice as well?
Thank you very much. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you are well aware, we're currently preparing a capital construction budget for community colleges and OUS, much of which involves building new facilities to increase the number and variety of healthcare workers. How would you see OCN playing a coordinating role in developing programs for those institutions?
I am on the the advisory role for the Oregon Center for Nursing would help to make sure that the programs that are developed for nursing would fit with the strategic plan that we're already developing, so that those programs would be and I believe actually one of them is what they're proposing are some additional OCNE seats. So that's a statewide nursing program that is going to build our pipeline to graduate education a little faster than we've been doing it right now. So that advisory role, and I'm already on a number of committees that help us help advise for the kind of work that's being developed. And we are also, I have another hat in that I hold the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council seat on the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute Board. And we're very involved in recommending for all of the health professions, not just nursing, from that hat. So, and that's where we're trying to establish this role. So we are part of this discussion.
Mr. Chair, I understand this is not a work session, but I will say that I think this bill is worthy of our support, and in fact the coordinating function is more important now than ever. There are a number of new programs that will be started based on this biennium's budget, and I think the role that OCN could play in ensuring that those programs meet standard professional requirements, as well as speed the development of qualified healthcare workers, is essential to our success in this area.
Thank you, Representative Edwards. So we're running out of time. In fact, the chair of a committee that I serve on just left, and he gave me the eye that I need to get to that committee. But before, I did have a request that if James Sager would have a chance to come up, maybe answer questions or a question. And
thank you.
I want to thank you, Ms. King, Ms. Campbell. I'm going to blame the senator to my right for this. Okay, Senator Devlin.
My apologies to Mr. Sager. I didn't give him the courtesy of telling him I'd ask him a question in advance.
It's like a house.
Yes.
We should see we do this all the time.
Yeah.
Mr. Sager, the governor in his recommended budget made broad recommendations in terms of improving education at OHSU and the OUS system in community colleges. And to a very large extent, probably to a 95% at least level or more, this committee has concurred with those recommendations. And to a large extent, most of those budgets, I believe, have passed the House and are headed to the Senate. And I'm expecting concurrence there. What does the governor see as the clear need for the Senate?
Chair Galizzi, members of the committee, for the record, James Sager, Governor's Office. It was somewhat alluded to in the testimony already, but one of the processes that we went through in preparing the governor's budget was trying to pull together all the entities to help us prioritize how to lay out the governor's budget to make sure that we meet the various needs, in this case in particular around health care. And so we see this bill as, again, helping us to align the right entities to help advise both the Federal Workforce Investment Board and the State Board of Education as we advise the governor then on coordinating these budgets. So we see this as just another important piece in bringing that alignment together, especially around healthcare, workforce, particularly nursing, and making sure that we have the alignment both in programmatic alignment as well as facility alignment and everything else coordinated.
And in a sense also, I think it goes along with Representative Edwards' comments, Mr. Chairman, in terms of we're making, and our previous discussion on 334, we're making incredible investments in terms of millions, and you could actually say tens of millions of dollars. I would assume the governor sees this as a way of trying to ensure that we actually get the product. I hate to talk about people as products, but we actually get the product we are seeking.
Senator Devlin, I think that you articulated that very well. It is a matter of making sure that we put forward the necessary investment, that we have the accountability pieces in place, and having this coordination and the ability to come back to all of you in a coordinated manner and be able to articulate what we're doing, and we think is very important.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Sager. I think, considering the late hour with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 4A, and we're adjourned.
Committee on Ways and Means,
the Education Subcommittee. It is Friday, June 15th, 2007, 3 p.m. in Hearing Room F. Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services. It is Saturday, June 16th, 2007, 10:30 a.m. in Hearing Room F.